Blog Talk Radio.
Aloha. Welcome to Talking Pictures. I'm your host, Paul Booth. Today is an extremely exciting episode. We're going to be talking with Newton Thomas Singel. He told me to call him Tom, and on IMDb you see Tom Singel. You will know this guy by his work. You film fans, DPs definitely know his name. But I'm going to run through some of the credits here so we save all the on-air time we can for him. A long collaboration with Bryan Singer, Usual Suspects, Superman Returns, X-Men, X-Men 2, X-Men Days of Future Past. He did the film Drive, Three Kings with George Clooney. George Clooney's first directorial effort, Confessions of a Dangerous Mind with Drew Barrymore, Leatherheads with Robert Baker. We got to interview him one time. I got to interview him. That was great. Wonderful guy from Memphis. Today, Bohemian Rhapsody is what we're going to be discussing. It comes out November 2nd. You'll see on your screen there. Tom has done TV movies, short films, documentaries. He did the American Master series for Martin Scorsese as a cinematographer, a documentary about Oliver Stone. So this Bohemian Rhapsody is really cool because it's Freddie Mercury, Queen, and some of the guys that he's gotten to talk to are just as historical. We're all humans, but they walk that line of there's some myth and critics judge them and they do great work. So I'm really interested to hear what this is like from someone who's been in the creative process in the main part. For those of you that don't know, new listeners and people who are just, we all learn about film, production designer, cinematographer, director are the main three. He even goes back to shooting the Wonder Years pilot, which for someone my age was a television changing moment with Kevin and Winnie's first kiss. He's worked with actors that became directors like Clooney, Redford's The Conspirator. See a great tie in here to historical films that he's done. So we're going to jump into that. He recently did Marshall with Kate Hudson about Thurgood Marshall, Chadwick Boseman. Of course, The Conspirator had to do with Lincoln. His second unit work involved Platoon. My dad's a Vietnam veteran, so maybe we'll mention some of that after we discuss Queen and Bohemian Rhapsody. What an interesting time for 70s music. Of course, excess, craziness, it's all on, throw it to the wind. To me, my opinion, Queen, I call it opera rock and roll. And that doesn't mean like the way Elton John would get all dressed up. It was like Freddie Mercury's this bigger than life thing. And you either, in my opinion, you either love Queen, have all their albums, you're nutty, or you just kind of know them as we are the champions, we will rock you. And of course, Bohemian Rhapsody. So this film's going to be coming out, this week, excuse me. You know, this show, of course, we're not censored. We want it to be a place for filmmakers to come and chat. We are just film lovers ourselves. And so we want it to just be about that. So we're students to artists as established as Mr. I'm saying Singel. I hope I'm not pronouncing it wrong when he calls in. We'll get a correction on that if I'm wrong. Let's see. I think this is him right now. Let me see. Welcome. Are you with us, Tom?
Yes, I am. Can you hear me okay?
Thank you so much for your time. We really appreciate this today.
Oh, no. It's my pleasure.
Excellent. Excellent. Well, I was just kind of giving the audience to save airtime some of your wonderful body of work from television to documentaries to just it almost seems like everything in between. And I had mentioned, you know, I was looking at this and I was just thinking, okay, where's there a commercial or a PSA? But from the get-go, I just wanted to say, of course, we're here to discuss Bohemian Rhapsody. For any guest, if there's a project that they don't want to do, something they don't want to say, feel free to say pass. We always want the guests to be comfortable. So one of my first questions was, because I could see we have enough stuff here to talk for the next 2 days, which I think is awesome, is with Bohemian Rhapsody and Queen, to me, Freddie Mercury is like a myth. You're either like a nut and you love him, or you're just kind of like, you know his music and you have your opinion. So other than great script and your longtime collaboration with Mr. Singer, what for you clicked inside to be like, I really want to make this movie? Was it like a long time you wanted to do something like this, or how did that process go for you?
I think when the possibility of doing this movie presented itself, there's so many reasons that I wanted to do it. I mean, it's a list. Firstly, I hadn't really done a sort of rock and roll movie or a musical. I'd done my share of music videos and musical scenes within movies, but I'd never really done a movie that was about music, or at least someone's, one particular artist's music. And a band like Queen that is so influential in popular music and rock and roll, sports. I mean, imagine, you know, that this strange English band with a gay icon as its front man has done the biggest, like, sports anthems played in stadiums all over the world, like We Will Rock You and Another One Bites the Dust. So, the visual opportunities, the time period, the music, Freddie's story. There's just so many reasons to do this movie. There wasn't even a moment's hesitation.
Well, I like what you're saying about the way music, the way it's so transcendent, and that's to think of it playing in all these stadiums. And all this stuff led me to thinking, now this is on Internet Movie Database for the audience, so I'm not spoiling anything, that the film leads up to Live Aid. I'm only 40, but I was fortunate enough to fall under music teachers who were DJs in the 70s, so I like music like I'm as old as my father. I saw just a clip where obviously you guys didn't have 50,000 extras, so with the visual effects, you've had multiple films where you've pushed the envelopes from Three Kings and how grainy that was. Pardon my language, we're not censored, but that movie like blew my fucking mind when I saw it. The visual effects for the stadium I'm interested in because, as an example, you shot Jack the Giant Slayer. A friend of mine was a pre-vis artist on there, and he's a producer of the show. So as a cinematographer, how do you work with lighting, say, for the pre-vis? Then you're having to light a concert and a concert within the film, but you don't have the visual of the audience in front of you. It's going to be added in later. So what is that like as a cinematographer to be shooting or framing something that's not there?
Well, for Bohemian Rhapsody, what we did, we had the most extras we ever had was about 900 extras. But we did have varying degrees of extras. And for Wembley, which is our sort of, if you will, third action or third act set piece, we did have the complete stage. We actually had a replica of the Wembley stage, including the backstage. So all of the stuff shooting toward the band and across the band, it was as if we were shooting a real concert and as if we had a live venue.
when we came around behind Freddie and the band, that's when we were looking at visual effects. A combination of the 900 extras we had and then supplementing them with various types of visual effects. Remembering that Wembley Stadium, where the concert occurred, no longer exists. There's now a Wembley Arena, a much smaller venue that looks nothing like the original stadium. So all of that became green screen, and we initially toyed with the idea of what we call a simulcam, which is where you can render a set, a virtual set, and composite it into your video viewing of the live camera. So you're taking your live camera and you're taking a virtual set that's been created previously, and you're compositing them live in camera, and you can kind of see, oh, if I bring the camera up a little higher, you know, I'll see more crowd. If I come down a little more, I'll see more, you know, sky, stadium, that kind of thing. And we did some of that in pre-visualization so that we had a sense of how to frame the stadium. But then when it came time to actually shooting, we decided not to go with the full-on simulcam like we did in Jack the Giant Slayer that you mentioned, because we really had a pretty good idea of the perspective of the stadium and how to frame for it. And by and large, it worked out really well, actually. You know, the crowd is maximized in the Wembley performance because it was such a defining performance in the history of rock. And it really turned the tide on the fundraising that was being done for Live Aid at the time. Queen really blew people away in that concert. They were a very popular band at one point. Their popularity was waning a little bit. At the time of Live Aid, you know, they weren't necessarily considered the most current band. And I don't think anybody expected a performance at the level that Freddie and the guys brought that day. The fundraising all of a sudden went crazy. The crowd all of a sudden went from being hot and miserable and sticky and bored to like totally coming alive. And it's the reason that it's that performance has become so legendary.
Well, for the and I believe it's two or three or even four discs to let audience know there is. It's very hard to find. I've only found it at the library once of the complete concert. And as you were mentioning that, I'm always curious, and for the audience as well. In these effect shots that you're talking about for Bohemian Rhapsody, I noticed you had the production designer, Aaron Hay. And if you were to look at this guy on IMDb, like yourself with your experience, of course you guys work your ass off, but you make it look so easy. You make it look like you're just maybe cutting your fingernails. This guy here, of course, stuff on Star Wars, Mars Attacks, working with Tim Burton, and we'll get into all the amazing directors that you've worked with. So what I always wonder is, with cinematographers, with these shots that you're discussing, is that what, aside from director, to create this the way, production designer, visual effects supervisor, what exactly is the chain of command? Because I'm looking at someone here who, say, did three Star Wars movies, and then you have some great effects films. So do you kind of Is it just an incredible shorthand? Had you worked with him, or is it just really going through what Mr. Singer wanted? I mean, how does that process work when it gets into the effects part of telling the story?
Well, you know, the chain of command, as you say, for me is always, as a cinematographer, is I'm working with the director. I'm sort of, you know, in theory, servicing the vision of that particular director. What that means specifically really depends on the director and what their particular process is or where their strengths are. You have the directors that are sort of more visually inclined, and then the ones that are more about the you know, performance or and every shade in between. On this particular project, for a variety of circumstances, I worked really closely with Aaron, the production designer, and we scouted all the locations and had a lot of discussions about how to photograph them and how to service the story with what the location brought, as well as how to, you know, design our sets, the sets that we did have specifically for what's, you know, what we needed to tell in the story. The concert itself, you know, and the stadium is a, you know, a real thing. It was something that we could draw on all of the historical footage and photographs, and even on some of the original set builders for the original Live Aid concert. So, you know, Aaron and I worked really closely to replicate things as much as we could. And, you know, discuss how we would be shooting, you know, how we would approach shooting for the film, in addition to what the actual venue or location might have looked like. And Wembley is a good example in that, as you mentioned, the BBC broadcast the whole event. There was like 13 satellites, and it was a big deal. And the BBC broadcast, you can see on YouTube. I mean, it exists. So for us, the question was, as a film telling a story, we didn't want to just replicate the BBC broadcast, yet we did want to replicate the venue and the feel of Wembley and what the stage looked like and what, you know, what the sort of tone of the performance was. The difference in the movie is that we, as a movie and as telling a story, we wanted to take the audience up onto the stage in a sort of more intimate relationship with the band, in particular with Freddie, than you have as an audience, you know, as somebody in the stadium in the audience or watching it on TV. So our story involves a lot more of the interaction between the different band members during the performance than you would say see by just watching the performance. So our camera work, our where the camera goes and what it expresses to our cinema audience is different than what you would get on YouTube. You know, if you wanted to see what the actual performance looked like, you can just watch YouTube. So that was the process, you know. I have done a lot of movies with Bryan Singer, and so, you know, there definitely was a kind of shorthand in terms of where his taste goes and his sort of likes and don't likes. So it was, you know, it was a lot of fun to sort of delve into that world. Well, you know, visual effects, when you're doing things like, you know, filming a concert in a stadium that doesn't exist, some of the most interesting and actually challenging effects, because you're trying to create something that's real. You're trying to create something that nobody considers is a visual effect. It's more invisible, and therefore, in a way, it needs to be more perfect. You know, when you start doing like spaceships or Wakanda or something, it's fantasy, and therefore it can be, you know, in some ways there's more leeway, because as an audience, you know, it's not real. You know, the spaceship isn't real. So it's just, there's already that kind of poetic license. Whereas when you're trying to create something like Wembley Stadium, you just want it to look the way Wembley would have looked if you were standing there in 1985. So in some ways it's even a bigger visual, you know, to make a visual effect look like it isn't a visual effect is the biggest challenge of all. That was a fun part of the show. Although it's not a heavy visual effects show, it's really, you know, the visual effects are almost, in the movie, are almost exclusively in the realm of recreating, you know, large stadiums and audiences.
Oh, yeah, well, right. That was why I jumped with that, because I thought there's probably not much here. And I see now that you've mentioned, and this ties into what you had mentioned about capturing history, was that, and of course tying it into Bohemian Rhapsody, is that it looks like you had some fairly great training, in the sense that you recently did Marshall. I had told the audience about that. And of course, we won't get into politics, but of course in today's climate, really happening to be accurate with that and the conspirator. And then pardon me for a moment to just say, thank you for your work on Platoon, because my father's a Vietnam veteran, so that's always a very important film to me, that brought to light what guys went through. So were you kind of, even though Freddie Mercury is so different than Justice Marshall or, say, a Vietnam veteran, just in how you approached Freddie Mercury for your side of working with Mr. Singer, could you kind of go back and be like, well, I've had to pretty accurately portray a really landmark judge, or I've had to portray Vietnam. I mean, not specifically, like, was there other projects that you've done where you could kind of be like, okay, I've had that in me to have to create history, so it kind of took maybe a little bit of the edge off of Bohemian Rhapsody?
Well, I don't know if it took the edge off. I mean, I think I love drawing on real-world characters, real-world events. So, you know, when Bohemian Rhapsody came around, the first thing I did was I read every book about Freddie. I read all the stuff about Queen. I knew Queen's music. I wasn't like a super fan, so I reacquainted myself with their music and the history of their music, the way it evolved, where it sat in the sort of lexicon of popular music in the 70s and the 80s. You know, whenever you know, I think artists, cinematographers draw on many different sources, whether it's painting or photography or other works of cinema. for their visual style and for their visual storytelling. And when you're telling a true story or a story based on true events, you know, you delve into the history that, that exists. And I find that that, you know, fuels a lot of the imagination. And then, you know, based on the particular project, you're making a choice of how much you're using that history as a means of doing something impressionistic, or whether you're which like maybe it would be the case of Three Kings, or whether you're using that history, or Confessions of a Dangerous Mind is another example, or whether you're using history for a movie like Marshall or Valkyrie, where you very much want to have historical fact and you're trying to create a historically true picture of a particular event or character. So, yeah, I think it's, you know, it's wonderful to be able to draw on actual history, actual people. All art, you know, comes from somewhere. You know, no artist works in a vacuum. So, you know,
I like that.
So, even in pure fiction, or in, you know, you're drawing on other on the work that's influenced you over the years, or whatever phase you are in your artistic evolution and process, whether it's conscious or subconscious, the other art that you've seen in your lifetime is going to feed and fuel the creative output of the moment.
Well, thank you for saying that, because one of the, your episode 306, and one of the things that we started from day one was we wanted to say, we want this show to be like, we had a student filmmaker on the day before we had Rachel Morrison. And to me, that was the biggest dream, because it was like someone who had never touched a camera. And then the next day, an Emmy nominated DP, to show that it was just like, we're all where we're at. We're all pulling in what we know. To jump into, I didn't read your bio before because I always read it to study, and I knew a lot of your work, but I didn't know this part, and I find it very interesting. And I will turn off my film history geek mode, because I see here that you caught the eye of the legendary Haskell Wexler, who I was fortunate enough to meet about 6 months before he passed away. And then also, when we were talking about actors, directors, and working on Blood and Wine with Bob Raffleson, Five Easy Pieces was another film. So some of these guys, I was kind of going through your list of the small areas that I didn't know. And it was kind of, you know how it is when you're, you know, that band that just always gets to you and makes your hair stand up on your arms, or like you were saying, you're always there. With Bohemian Rhapsody, because there's a, we don't need to spoil anything by saying, did you take a sometimes documentary feel, sometimes just regular film feel, but with your documentary experiences in these Nicaragua, Report from the Front, and then also just doing like Oliver Stone, Inside Out, American Masters, Martin Scorsese, has some of these things, because of your experience, is it like second nature when you need to use your documentary technique? Or I'm just always intrigued by cinematographers that have so many different styles, if it is just like talking, or if you are kind of like, you know, almost like you have to be like, okay, I kind of got to think about my documentary style here. Like, how did that work for you in in anything or Bohemian Rhapsody specifically?
Well, you know, I've been making movies since I was in high school, and I started out making movies sort of in the height of the what they call the experimental or avant-garde or personal filmmaking. You know, the small 16-millimeter cameras had come into being, and you could actually just pick up a camera by yourself and film and add a little sound and tell a little story. So I started from that place. I got involved in documentary. At the time, I was painting as well. When I got involved in documentary, I met two very close friends at the time that we became a little triangle of documentary filmmaking, and found myself in a lot of war zones and exciting sort of historical events. But my origins, having been in sort of the art world, painting world and all of that, were always there and were applying themselves to the way I was treating photojournalism or reportage. So there was already from the very beginning of my documentaries, to a certain degree, they were being influenced by, or you could say polluted by, the art world origins. And so I think for me early on, there was a blending of the two aesthetics, and I found that they, over the years, they've informed each other, sometimes through a frustration. You know, when you're doing a documentary, there's times when you wish, oh, why doesn't the guy stand a little more to the right so I can, his face isn't blocked, you know, or, you know, I missed that guy, you know, falling off the cliff. I wish he would go back up and fall off again. If only, you know, that riot happened in the backlight. There's, you know, as a visual artist, you often in a documentary, you have that frustration, but then you go to a feature film where you have all the control and the actors will stand where you want and you can put the lights where you want, and you long for something spontaneous and unexpected and unpredictable like you have in a documentary. So I think, I think the two worlds and everything in between inform every movie I do. And Bohemian Rhapsody, there's an evolution of style in the movie that was not so much to make it look like a documentary or not, but really more to sort of emotionally communicate the formation of Queen, the growth of Freddie, and the transformation of Queen from 1970 to this sort of celebratory moment in 1985 at Live Aid. So the band went through a tremendous evolution and change, and Freddie in particular, who was kind of a shy, awkward Parsi immigrant in London, to somebody who, you know, began to embrace his own identity, to his own sexual identity, to he really made quite a journey from where he was when he first met Roger Taylor and Brian May to where he was at the end. So the visual style of the film is an attempt to reflect that emotionally and philosophically, The movie begins in 1970, much more handheld and sort of idealistic and romantic, naive a little bit. It's all handheld up to the point where they really start to explode on the national stage, and then the film becomes more sort of controlled, and as you move, you know, toward the 80s and into the 80s, the color palette changes, the quality of the light changes, and it's hopefully a reflection of what the band, and particularly Freddie, was going through.
I'm not sure
if that answered your question or not.
Oh, no, that did. No, and also, too, I don't mean it like it wasn't an answer, but another thing of our show is we just love what artists say. So everything, I always joke that I'm getting a free master's class every week. So it's like, whether it's an art director or a production designer, or if you do something I don't do, I'm the double winner here. The other thing that I was interested in is I didn't count the exact, but I think it was around 7 or 8 films with Mr. Singer. So obviously, without being personal, is there a way where whether it's Bohemian Rhapsody, just to kind of step to the side for a second, of course, every director puts their stamp, but whenever I've talked to a cinematographer who has a long time, like Any Given Sunday felt so different because it wasn't Robert Richardson, and no disrespect to Mr. Saltotino. So is there, have there been any films that you've come across? I'm sorry, let me jump back to Axel Wexler. You having a painting, experimental film, documentary background, would you mind telling us anything at all about Axel Wexler? Because I saw Coming Home and was just like, I got D's in cinematography, but I want to be a cinematographer because Axel Wexler. So just for the history of it in the audience, is there anything you could share briefly about him?
Well, Axel was, Axel is really like my godfather in the feature film world. In the history there goes something like this, where, I had seen Coming Home and I'd seen Bound for Glory, Days of Heaven, but the film that was really intriguing for me, as amazing as all as his work on all those films, was Medium Cool, which is the first feature he directed. The reason being was that that was truly a melding of documentary and fiction. He had a story that he was telling, story about a news cameraman, but he also took his actors right into the middle of the actual demonstration against the Democratic Convention in Chicago. So,
right, 68.
It was a really bold, experimental approach to narrative storytelling that I had never seen anything like that before. I was fortunate because Pascal had seen some of the documentaries that I had done, particularly in Central America. And when he approached me with the story he had about the repression in Nicaragua during the time of Somoza. And my partner and I read the script that he was working on, and we said, you know, Haskell, what do you think about doing, you know, as opposed to doing something about what's happened historically, why don't we do something about what's happening, do something very contemporary? At the time, at the moment when I first met Haskell, the Sandinistas had overthrown the dictator Somoza, and the Reagan administration was secretly funding a counter-revolutionary army in order to overthrow the Sandinista government. So even though it wasn't acknowledged, we said to Haskell, you know, what do you think about making your script sort of more contemporary? And he loved the idea. And while he was starting to think about how to develop the script, there was a huge military exercise being organized between Honduras and the United States, which is right on the Honduras is right on the Nicaraguan border. And he said, why don't you go down and film this military exercise so we can have footage of helicopters and all kinds of stuff that we won't be able to afford on our real budget and on our movie. So my partner and I went down and we filmed the military exercise, but then we stayed in Honduras and we spent quite a bit of time there. And eventually we became the first people that ever filmed the what they called the Contras, or this counter-revolutionary army. We hiked with them from Honduras over the mountains into Nicaragua and sort of went into battle with them. And it became a big news story that sort of broke the story that indeed these guys existed and indeed the U.S. was funding them. Then we went back to Nicaragua and we filmed the same war zone from the other side with the Sandinistas. So we filmed a war sort of from the two sides, which is something you very rarely ever get to do, because typically once you've been on one side of a military conflict, the other side isn't very welcoming. So that's what led to the documentary Report from the Front. And Haskell used that documentary and the experiences that we had there as a kind of stepping off point for his next feature, which was the second and only other narrative feature that he made. He made a lot of documentaries, but he only made the two features called Latino, and that was my first feature film, and he was very gracious to ask me to be the cinematographer, which I was too naive and young and ignorant to realize what an amazing honor and opportunity that was. I mean, I was totally unqualified for it, but Haskell was a tremendous mentor and inspiration. And, you know, this is a man who lived into his 90s and was making movies right to the very end, who never gave up his passion both for cinematography and for social activism. He always saw cinema as a means of communication and of creating polemics, and he stayed true to his beliefs from I think the minute he picked up a camera to the day he passed away. He was an amazing force of nature and inspiration for me then and to this day. He's never far from me when I work.
I thank you for sharing that, because he, when I saw him at the ASC clubhouse and we met Meredith because of Mr. Richard Crudo, and he said, talk to anyone you want. And I saw Haskell Wexler walking up, and I just thought, I'm not into celebrity. People are people. I respect the work. And I got to stop him. Long story short, I told him how I made a film about my friend who was a homeless veteran, and it was all because of Coming Home. And I tried to stage it like Bound for Glory, talk about naivete, like you can shoot like Haskell Wexler on your first short. And I ended up telling him, long story short, that I said my film had senators mad at me, my local mayor, the governor, and even two U.S. senators. And he got a big smile and said, man, that's great. And I thought, you know what? That's so wonderful that Haskell Wexler liked that my governor and mayor was mad at me. I said, I'll take that as being cooler than anything. And he thanked me for stopping him. And so I really appreciate you sharing that, Haskell Wexler. Yeah. One of a kind. And I mainly just went into that because I'm too young to say young people, but I really just want people to always remember to look that up and to pay attention to his films. Something that also comes up, as we both know, with in working with celebrities, and that we're all just human beings, that I've always wondered about, and this ties back into Freddie Mercury, is that there's, of course, been a myth built around Jack Nicholson, that people are like, oh my God, he's Jack, and which he earns, but I'm just speaking in terms of the, that we don't see him as a guy who, you know, goes home and pees when he needs to. Was there any kind of actors or people that you had worked with where you could pull a little bit from the, because to me, Freddie Mercury, I'm 40, so Freddie Mercury to me is the right before Live Aid, gets AIDS, died, and you only associate We Are the Champions, We Will Rock You, and Another One Bites the Dust. So for the younger generation and those people who think of Jack and think Batman and have no idea about the last detail, speaking of like Hal Ashby and them, has there ever been a like an actor that you can kind of take from and be like, I can apply this to the next time there's like a larger than life character who I know is really just a human being?
I draw a lot from actors. I mean, there's, you know, I've been really blessed. I've worked with so many amazing actors and seen so many different avenues and routes to, you know, a great performance, that I find it really inspirational. Jack was great. I loved working with him. And he was like, you know, it was pretty early in my career, and he was one of the first actors I ever worked with that I, first one who did this, but the first one that I really noticed it, where he really understood the light and he played the light. And I would light a set and he would come in and instinctively know like where to stand, where to be, where to look, how to make, like how to use the light as one of his sort of creative tools. And it was like, I was like, wow, you know, this is Jack. This is amazing. I don't have to say anything. You just, you know, right away, like, you know, what to do, where to go. And you know, that was something that I really sort of blew me away when I worked with him. But, I mean, there's, you know, Jennifer Lawrence was somebody who amazed me at how effortless her performances are and how, I'm sure internally she goes through a lot that you don't see, but on set and working with her, it seemed like the minute somebody says, you know, roll camera, action, this unbelievable thing just comes to life. And looking through the lens at her is like you feel like you've been transformed into some other place. So I think there's a tremendous amount of inspiration that you can draw from actors. It's interesting because, you know, like I'm prepping a movie right now, and so I'm working with the director, and we're shot listing, and we're discussing how we're going to shoot scenes based on the story, based on the locations we have. And, you know, there's dramatic scenes you come to that, you know, might be 3-4 pages of dialogue in a room, a couple of people in a room. And so you, you know, you want to have a plan. My nature is to actually plan every shot and know every single thing I'm going to do before I start. So you read your script, you think of your location, you think of how you're going to block it, where you're going to put the camera, what kind of shots you want, how much coverage, what style, what's the tone, what's the movement or non-movement. But then I find that when you have a scene that is really very much in a dialogue scene or an acting scene, you have that plan. You have to be very careful not to marry yourself to that, so that when the actor shows up and has a different idea or does a different take on something, you're open to it. And very often it'll be better than anything you imagine. Sometimes it's off kilter and you want to steer them back to your original plan, but very often they'll bring things that you never imagined. And that goes all the way back to the very first time I ever directed actors, which was I did a documentary about Guatemala, and we had to do a historical recreation to make the audience understand the sort of U.S.-Guatemala relationship, which was really forged back in the 50s with the overthrow of Jacobo Arbenz. So we had this little dramatic scene that we did to fit into our documentary, and I had written it, and so I sort of heard the dialogue in my mind as I was writing it. And then when it went into the hands of the actors, and the first time we just read through it, all of a sudden I was like, oh, wow, I never thought about saying it like that. That's so interesting. It's so much better than what I was thinking, you know. So,
right, like a magic appears all of a sudden, right?
I do believe there's a certain magic in acting. You know, there's an intelligence that is sometimes involved where an actor can sort of have an intellectual take on a character or performance. But there's also something that is really undefinable, and you can't really figure out why Michael Fassbender, every time he opens his mouth, it's profound and it has gravitas and it's so powerful. You know, I think, for all of the premeditated and the intellectual aspects a particular actor might bring to a role or performance, there is really something that some people have that is just very magical, and the reason that they become great performers and others don't. I mentioned Jennifer Lawrence. She's another one who, I mean, I don't know where it comes from or what it is, but you look at her through the lens and you roll the camera and there's just something special that happens that sweeps you away. And how much of it is something that she's thought through, and how much of it is just her being is a mystery that I don't think I'll ever truly understand. There's definitely alchemy in acting.
Or I heard a great quote from Paul Thomas Anderson, Charlie Rose was interviewing him and Daniel Day-Lewis, and he asked Paul Thomas Anderson about a certain scene, that scene when the kid gets blown off the rig, and Paul Thomas Anderson just said, there's certain voodoo magic I'm just not supposed to know, and I actually don't want to know. I'm at the monitor. I'm also a fan. He's going to deliver, and it's his thing. And when I look at something here that I want to draw out to audience, I can only relay this and relate to it of I got to go through The Graduate to Jaws when I was 19 and discovered that whole time of the studio falling to where I saw the last picture show, The Graduate, Paper Moon, discovered all those directors in the same 2 weeks. So my head was just like effed up. And I'm looking here at yourself and you get to be a part of reinventing Superman. Then you go on to do a movie with Alan Ball. Then you get to be a part of Clooney's diving back into directing, which I haven't seen Towelhead, but I've seen Superman Returns, Leatherheads, Valkyrie. You get to get back into history. And then Leap Year, this wonderful little movie. I don't know, I guess 2010. I was going through a very tough time in my life, so it might have been a bigger hit than I had heard. But then you get Amy Adams. Then you go to Halle Berry with Frankie Alice. And then you're working with Redford as a director and doing Drive. So I couldn't even imagine what that two-year period would do to an artist's head in a good way. If I just met those five people in ten days, I would be like, whoa.
I mean, I've been blessed, right? And I think, you know, most cinematographers that have been doing, as long as I've been doing it, you will have worked with some pretty amazing people and incredible talent, and it's the joy of what we do. You know, I mean, we get to, you know, we get to play with all these great artists, and it's kind of like being a freelance musician. You know, where, you know, you get to play with Queen one day and the Beatles the next. You know,
right?
Like, it's an amazing privilege, and it's really fun to watch and to watch, you know, because actors are all so different. I mean, my God, you know, you mentioned Daniel Day-Lewis is, you know, from, I've never worked with him, but from everything I understand, you know, really different process than, say, Jack Nicholson. So, you know, it's one of the great things about what we do.
I saw Ben Kingsley the other night in Operation Finale, which I know people, I understand why we avoid Holocaust films, but he played Adolf Eichmann, and he was just so engulfing. I mean, I was sitting on the edge of my seat as if I was watching an action film, and he was just sitting there saying, yeah, Tom, I was a Nazi soldier, and I was just, what's he going to do? What's he do next? And then he just ate a cracker. And I was like, he's eating a cracker and I'm entertained. So this brings me to, it can be to any film, or maybe we could lean it towards Bohemian Rhapsody. If you have I pretty much ask every guest this, if they have a lesson where you got to come home, it could be a lesson for yourself or a lesson for others, to where you just came home from set that day and you were able to kind of think, you know what? I don't know if I would have ever learned this had I not been doing Bohemian Rhapsody. A filmmaking lesson. Oh, you know what? The caller dropped. I'm sorry. He'll call right back in. That never happens. We're still on air. So we're going to wait for the caller to call right back in. Again, we're talking with Tom Siegel. I still haven't asked him to pronounce what the correct pronunciation is on that. He's calling right back in. He might have missed my question. Oh, sorry about that.
Yeah, I did.
Tom.
Sorry about that.
Okay. Did you catch the question, or did it drop before?
No, it my phone died there. I had to switch phones.
Oh, okay. So
hello, can you hear me okay?
Oh yeah, I can totally hear you. Can you hear me okay?
I can.
Okay.
Yeah.
So just basically, it was, did you have a lesson on Bohemian Rhapsody or maybe another film to where you were able to just sit down and be like, you know what? I don't think I would have learned that had I not done this project. Not personally, but just basically that epiphany that we all get as artists.
Yeah, I mean, I think on quite a few. You know, first of all, on every documentary I ever worked on, you know, I mean, the great thing about documentaries is that you're almost by definition being taken to places, and when I say places, I mean both places and, you know, sort of historical places that you might never go otherwise, because and that's the reason that the documentary is being made. And in the world of narrative filmmaking, like I was mentioning earlier, you know, when you do stories, sort of true stories or stories that are based on some kind of fact, the research and the recreation that you have to do does, you know, is very transformative. I think one of the ones that was most, for me, you know, one of the most powerful was doing Valkyrie, which was the story of the pretty much one attempt from inside Germany that the German military made to get rid of Hitler. And it was particularly powerful for me because my mother was born in Berlin. She fled the Nazis. Most of her side of the family was killed in the camps. So it was a very personal story for me. And my mom was at the end of her life. I had hoped to be able to bring her to Germany. She ended up not being able to go because of her health had just deteriorated too much. But it was very much a you know, a very strange and powerful personal project to do something about one of the most vile people in history. At the same time, as you're not only sort of reliving some of the horror that your mother went through, but you're actually doing it in the same place. I mean, we filmed in Berlin, and, you know, we executed Stauffenberg, the Tom Cruise character, in the very place where it really happened. So, you know, it was
wow.
That was a very powerful experience on that level.
Wow. Well, I'm no words for the sorriness on that. I actually watched that again last night, and yeah, I mean, I won't praise it or anything, but it was very, I mean, the work was fantastic. I'm sorry, I don't mean to go from talking about losing family to saying how great film stock was, pardon that. But the capturing of historical moments, and by the way, thank you for sharing something and being so open, because that's another thing with the show. We cannot stand shows that push and pull and prod and want to exploit. So when a guest is open like that, we want to take the time to stop and say thank you for sharing that. Now, the last couple of questions are just kind of the ones that we kind of do to turn it to the fun side of just being a cinematographer and an artist yourself? And actually, I don't know if this question can apply because you've done so many different things, but of course, there's always new stuff to explore. Do you have you know, the scripts there, the directors there, the budgets there? Do you have a dream genre that, you know, before you hang up your camera, it's going to say you shot one of those?
I have quite a few. You know, I love science fiction. I would love to do a really, you know, I mean, I've done my mild versions of it, but I'd love to do like a real full-on science fiction movie. And I love, like we've been talking about, I love movies that deal with real life issues, that deal with sort of our human condition, so to speak. So I love that genre as well. You know, I think I loved doing music. This was so much fun doing Bohemian Rhapsody. You know, I think it would be great to do like a musical. I can think of many kinds of genres that I'd love to tackle. I mean, you know, mostly it's really about just great storytelling. And, you know, you go for the script and the director and actors involved. You look at that sort of package and take a leap of faith and hope that you know, when you roll the dice, it comes up.
It's interesting because I've asked production designers, art directors, actors, actresses, indie, your level, and I want to say of, you know, the people that Meredith have got us, Greg Fraser and Rachel Morrison, Richard Crudo, almost every cinematographer said science fiction. And I just found that so interesting. And I know it's because the colors and the palettes, and it's something that's not there, and maybe we don't know the moon. And my gosh, did Roger Deakins kill it with Blade Runner last year? The next question is just basically the opposite of, you're back to that day where you weren't making a nice salary as a filmmaker. The lights are off. They're going to repossess your car. You're sleeping on a friend's couch. But they offer to do you to do this genre, and just you're not going to do it. Your name's not going to appear on filming it. Is there one you would not do?
I don't think there's a genre that I wouldn't do. You know, I think there's definitely, you know, if you find the sort of message of a movie or what you think the movie is expressing is, you know, it is not positive or healthy, or you know, if you ask yourself, does the world really need this movie? And the answer is no. Well, then, or would the world be better off without this movie? Pretty much tells you shouldn't be doing it. I mean, there's certain genres, you know, like romantic comedy is one. I've done a little bit, but not much. And it's not generally something people come to me for. I don't think there's a genre that, like, oh God,
never do a Western, you know. I mean, I would love to do a Western. So
that
I think,
and Hallmark movies have been the ones that people say no. Rom-com, or they don't want to do no Hallmark, or the Lifetime movies, to where it seems like it's the same ending. The guy's going to come back or not, or the woman's going to lose her job or not. So again, I think what you're saying is it goes back to stories, not that you can create a wonderfully visual Hallmark movie. They have that format, and I don't like to knock it because one of our guests does them every holiday, and she's a great actress, and she's been in lots of stuff dating back to Dune, Miss Alicia Witt, and but she does those cute Christmas movies, and but yeah, they're not like stretching her like Justified or Mr. Holland's Opus as a kid, or but yeah, that's really interesting. Sci-fi and romantic comedy seems to have a weird tie-in. And then the two things that I'd wrap up with, if you don't mind another minute or two. And again, thank you for your time and just some quick show maintenance. You guys can find this on, well, you'll find this where you're seeing it right now, but you can tell your friends www.talkingpicturesla.com. We also just launched a blog on the main page. You'll find we get advanced film reviews of stuff coming to the to LA and New York, and we get stuff coming to Prime. And then also on there, you can find an interview with Rachel Morrison and Greg Fraser. And we are the last show on the planet that name drops, but I, you know, we both understand the marketing game. And before I go into this last thing again, thank you for your time, and to Meredith and Jessica and all that wonderful team. My last thing would be cinema, just a couple of cinematographer influences, and maybe if it was to make it easier, ones that you, well, obviously you haven't worked on them unless it's second unit, but do you have that two or three where I call them your house is on fire and you would grab their DVDs because, you know, you got to have Shawshank Redemption to see what Roger Deakins' helicopter shot. Could you mention a few of those? And this is just so audience knows to keep the tradition going and, you know, pay attention to history.
Well, I mean, I think, you know, every generation has its great, you know, heroes. And, you know, I grew up under the very long shadow of the Conrad Halls, Haskell Wexler, Vittorio Storaro. And I think, you know, today our Roger Deakins, Emmanuel Lubezki, Robert Richardson, you know, the people that are sort of taking their place are, you know, equally influential and spectacular in their work. You know, you mentioned Greg Fraser, Rachel Morrison, and, you know, there's a whole new generation being created even as we speak. And actually, I think, you know, because of the tools we have available to us now, some of the work, you know, on a broad scale that's being done is extraordinary. And I think audiences are now, you know, throughout cinema history, we as artists are in part creating a literacy amongst an audience about how to look at movies. So the you know, what is considered beautiful, what is considered good and bad, changes as you know, as people, as cinema language evolves. And I think we you know, our audiences are
Oh, shoot, I think the call just dropped again, which just happens. So he was mentioning the new generation, and he'll call right back in. Again, for those of you who miss it, who write this down, Roger Deakins, Shawshank Redemption, Coen Brothers movies, True Grit, No Country for Old Men, Robert Richardson, all of Stone's earlier films, Robert Richardson with Platoon, and then his stuff with Casino, his work with Scorsese, Robert Richardson, even Tarantino. So write those names down, and now we'll go back to what Tom was saying.
I just think that, you know, it's quite remarkable the, you know, how audiences today can watch a film much more with a much higher level of sophistication than they did just 10, 20 years ago. When I started my career, you know, there was every cinematographer argued with every producer about whether something was too dark or not. Now it's like you can't go dark enough, you know. So I think there's just extraordinary work being done now, and
yeah, and I don't want it to be dropped. I'm always telling people, and people, you know, they think, God forbid, you love cinema, and especially because I'm only 40, so they're like, you're not 60, but it's like, you know, like Greg Toland. I say, if you like Citizen Kane, you got to like Greg Toland. If you like Grapes of Wrath, you got to like Greg Toland. You like On the Waterfront, you got to like Boris Kaufman, 12 Angry Men. So, you know, these guys, like you were saying, I'm so glad you said Conrad Hall. I think Butch and Sundance, the hair on my arms is still standing up from the way he captured the West. And then I remember when American Beauty came out, I was in film school, and people would say, oh, it's so sad that he died just as things were getting started. And I was like, this is Conrad Hall's third Oscar. Like, he's like, it's sad that he died, but American Beauty wasn't his break. So, you know, I'm not being snobby at all. So I'm very glad you said him, because we really want this show to also educate and promote as well as entertain. So, yeah, thank you for that. And, yeah, so this has been a great time. I've had a blast, and we of course wish you the best with Bohemian Rhapsody, and we will be out seeing it, so we're excited about it. I'm a rock film nut. I didn't bring it up because I didn't want to fly the train off the track about rock films and rock docs and going to concerts. So I truly appreciate this.
The movie is really great. It's a great, great movie, and I encourage you to see it in IMAX, which I think November 2nd, or it may only be for a week, but for that first week, every IMAX theater in the country will be playing Bohemian Rhapsody, and it's in IMAX. It's mind-blowing.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you for that, because the last awesome rock doc I saw was it's just playing on the indie circuit, but it's a Paul Butterfield story. It's called Horn from the Heart, and it had so much of that Paul Butterfield blues band music. And I remember sitting in the back row, surround sound, with my head against the speaker. I had a headache for a half hour and couldn't hear for 20 minutes, and it was totally worth it. So thank you.
I remember his album as well.
Oh, East West, and oh man, what I always say, I don't remember life before the first album, and once East West hits, like, I just say it's over. There's not turning back from that. So I'm glad we saved it to where there's not enough time to forget about why we were here. So of course, have a wonderful night and a great weekend. And of course, Meredith will get you the length of this. And it was very much a pleasure talking to you, Tom.
Thank you. Likewise. Thank you very much.
Excellent. Take care and aloha.
Same to you. Bye-bye.
Bye. And that wraps up our interview with Mr. Tom Siegel. It's Newton Thomas Siegel. If you look him up, he mentioned to call him Tom. So that's going to do it for me. I am not literally, but I am high as a kite. I get so hyper doing these shows. This is my, I call it being a pig in shit. So I'm going to wrap up and I'm going to say, as always, episode 307 closes with me telling you whether it's morning, afternoon, or night, make sure and watch a good movie. Take care, and Bohemian Rhapsody coming in a few days to cinemas. Aloha.